The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Wheelock, Judge Cleary, the Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is May 4th, 2022, and we're hearing our arguments this morning on Zoom.gov. Thank you for working with us to do that. We have six cases on our calendar today. Two of them are oral. Marshall, will you call the first case?
The first case is George Hadrick et al. v. Sylvester Gies et al. File number A220061.
Counsel, as you probably know, just as you would in our regular courtroom, each of you will have 15 minutes for your main argument. And counsel for appellant, you'll begin and you'll have an additional 5 minutes available for rebuttal. There is a clock, as you will note, in one of the Zoom boxes, so it will help you keep track of your time. Also, because these we are recording and posting these oral arguments on our website, please be sure and introduce yourself and who you represent at the beginning of each of your arguments. And with that, counsel for appellant, we'll turn to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Morley. I represent the appellants in this matter, George and Sharon Hadrick. Your Honors, my clients respectfully request that this court reverse the summary judgment dismissal of their complaint. I make this request because questions of material fact exist, specifically on the question of whether consideration was paid as provided in the option to purchase contract at issue in this case. Your Honors, this is simply a case where the parties used ambiguous language in the agreement itself to describe the consideration that was to be paid by the respondents to the Hadricks for the option to purchase.
Counsel, why do you find that ambiguous? Consideration in the form of the installation of tiling upon the option property at a significant discount. Didn't your clients acknowledge that back in 2012 when they signed the option?
Your Honor, a recitation of consideration received under a contract is merely prima facie evidence of the receipt of that consideration, and it can be impeached by extrinsic evidence, which is our request here. And the evidence is that to date, and well, I should say to the point where the complaint was served in this lawsuit, no party knew the amount of the alleged discount that had been given to the Hadricks for that work. And the agreement itself, by using the term significant discount, used an internally ambiguous term. We don't know what was meant by the term significant without going to extrinsic evidence to determine that. So the lack of evidence, and specifically admissible evidence here, of what that discount was, if it was even given, combined with the ambiguous nature of the terms in the contract itself, specifically the term significant, means a trial is necessary to flush out those issues.
But you would agree that your clients acknowledged receiving consideration in some form?
They signed a document that said that consideration had been received, and yes, that was merely prima facie evidence of receipt. But as I said, to that point, because no party had ever calculated any discount, all that they could go off of at that time was oral assurances from the respondents that that a discount had been given. And the amount of consideration was placed in controversy when the complaint was served for a notice pleading state. I know the respondents made an argument that the complaint itself is an admission that proper consideration was received, but there was no such admission. The complaint here simply put the parties on notice that the consideration was at issue, the sufficiency of it specifically. And now that we've gotten into discovery and still have yet to see admissible evidence of the alleged amount of discount provided, we need to proceed to trial.
Counsel, one of the things I struggle most with your argument is the fact that this tiling work, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, was done before the option contract was executed. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. It was done the fall prior to the option contract being signed. The option contract was signed in the summer of 2012.
So my concern is, well, this is the, the parties both acknowledging that there was a significant discount given. So it wasn't like, well, in the future, we're going to get a significant discount. I would find that easier to understand than, weren't the parties at that time in the best position to decide whether it was significant, so that all we're left with is just, was there a discount at all? Because a discount at all would be consideration. So help me with that, with my concern, if you would.
Sure. I'll make two points. And first, I'll talk to the latter point you made, where you say the question would be just whether there was consideration at all. That might be the case if the term significant wasn't used in the contract itself. There is case law out there, and I'll acknowledge Mr. Von Korff put it in his brief, that says the court is not to inquire as to the sufficiency of consideration. But we have to here because it's written into the contract. The term significant discount is used in the contract itself. So you can't say that a $1 discount is sufficient here because it's not significant per the terms of the contract. So first, we need a trial to determine what was meant by the term significant, which takes us out of the realm of that case law saying the court needs to stay out of the sufficiency of consideration. And the second point that I would make here is back to my earlier point that a statement of consideration in the contract is merely prima facie evidence that that was received. This is a, even though it references tiling work, at its core, the consideration stated in this agreement is simply pecuniary in nature because it talks about reducing a monetary debt owed by the Hadriches to the Geises. It does reference what the debt was for, the tiling work, but at its core, it's just a pecuniary interest. So it's really in practice no different than a statement that X amount of dollars was going to be paid. But because they didn't define what the amount of dollars was, it puts us in the realm of the Lindquist case, which I discuss at length in my brief, where the contract itself and specifically the consideration terms of the agreement itself in that case was deemed ambiguous because you couldn't decipher an actual amount that was to be paid as consideration under the contract. I would also point out that the Minnesota Supreme Court itself has said that summary judgment is improper where the terms of a contract are ambiguous. This is the Dene versus Bolwari opinion that's cited in our materials, where the court very specifically said that because contract language is ambiguous, a trial is needed to fully consider the extrinsic evidence of what is meant by the ambiguous language in the contract. And here, specifically, we need a trial to determine what is meant by the term significant discount and whether that was achieved here.
So, counsel, if I may, should we be, if we thought that this was ambiguous language, the contract was ambiguous, should we be construing those ambiguities against your client since the option contract was drafted? As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, by your lawyer for your client?
Well, this is where we get into a difficulty in the fact that my client's deposition transcript is not in the record, but the story told in deposition testimony is that although it was the attorney who was known to my clients and used for their to set up their trust fund, for instance, and their will, that they had limited conversations with that attorney, and the Geises worked as much, if not more, with that attorney.
If that's not in the record, then it's not
right.
Something we can
consider. Yeah, so I guess bottom line is I can't stipulate to the fact that that my clients were the ones primarily working with that attorney to create the contract. But yes, they did make the initial contact because it was an attorney they had worked with previously.
And that's in the record.
That part is in the record. I believe that's in the responses to requests for admissions.
And was this issue of whose lawyer drafted the contract and, you know, any implications of that, was that addressed before the district judge on summary judgment by either party?
I don't believe that specific issue was raised, although I could be mistaken on that. I just simply don't recall. So, I guess I'd like to switch gears, if the court will allow, and talk about another reason that summary judgment is improper here, is that there are significant, as I said, there's already material questions of fact here, but there's also significant shortcomings in the evidentiary record here, where, as I mentioned, there is not admissible evidence in the record of the amount of the alleged discount here. And I outlined this in the reply brief. I'd just like to summarize the argument. The only mention of that amount is in Sylvester Geisy's deposition transcript, which is a deposition in which he made it very clear that he was not qualified to testify as to the financials of his tiling company's business. His wife, Mary, would be the only one who was able to testify to those matters. And she, it's not that her deposition isn't in the record here. She did not give deposition testimony in this case yet. So she had not testified. So the piece of paper that, again, is not part of the record on appeal, but was provided in discovery that shows her calculations of this alleged discount, is hearsay. It's no more than hearsay because she hasn't testified. It's not a business record because it was created after this litigation began. So a good at least 8 years after the events took place. And that makes Sylvester Geisy's mention of the exact amount of the alleged discount, which is about $21,000 and change, hearsay within hearsay. So we're on summary judgment, but the defendants in this case have not given admissible evidence of what their alleged discount was. And on top of that, Sylvester Geisy's deposition transcript has internal inconsistencies that themselves create a question of material fact, because on one hand, he alleges that he gave a certain percentage discount on his standard rates, for instance, a 50% discount on the per foot installation rate for this drain tile, and also a discount on some hourly rates for the use of excavation equipment. But he also testified that he would have a standard rate sheet at his house available to show the rates that were normally charged in that time frame, in the 2011 time frame. That has not been produced, nor has nor have they been able to identify any other customers, any other projects with enough detail to allow investigation as to whether those quote-unquote standard rates were charged to other customers for similar projects in the same time frame. They did send over two invoices that are heavily redacted, don't give any identifying information, but include what they claim to be the standard rates. But without knowing who that work was done for or on what fields that work was done, we don't know if the work was similar and if it can be comparing apples to apples if you compare those projects to ours. So the trial court simply needs a chance at trial to determine whether those rates were actually the standard rates in 2011 as alleged by Mr. Geisy. So those internal inconsistencies in his deposition transcript by themselves create a material question of fact. But on top of that, my clients denied specifically, as in response to the request for admissions, that those discounts were provided. And that, again, creates questions of material fact. I already commented on the claim that the recitation about consideration in the complaint itself is not an admission, so I'll skip that. But I would say I guess that's all I have to say on the question of evidence. I would like to point out that there is Minnesota case law precedent for the relief requested by the Handriches here. And specifically, there's case law precedent for voiding a purchase option contract for lack of payment of consideration. And that's the Morrison versus Johnson case, longstanding case, just turned 100 years old. So in that case, it was stipulated that the $1 consideration stated in the contract was not paid. And the contract was considered void.
But isn't that different here, counsel? Because everyone agrees there was I thought it was undisputed that there was a discount. It's just you're questioning whether or not it's significant and then whether that is appropriate for summary judgment.
Your Honor, yeah, thank you for letting me clarify that. We have alternative arguments here. One argument is, just as you said, that if there was a discount, it wasn't quote-unquote significant as the contract calls for. But at this point in discovery and seeing the shortcomings in what the respondents have been able to show as far as their alleged standard rates at the time, our alternative argument is that no discount was given. Because on the face of the invoices to the Hadriches for the work in August of 2011, there is no such discount referenced. So yeah, there's alternate arguments, but one argument is, as you said, that it's a question of sufficiency. So what you have to look at, you have to compare the two contracts. In Morrison, the contract was very simple and said the consideration is payment of $1, and that payment simply wasn't made. Here, the consideration is a quote-unquote significant discount. It's more of a gray area, but it still begs the question of whether that term in the contract was satisfied. And if not satisfied, the relief should be the same as it was in Morrison, that the consideration as defined in the contract was not paid. Therefore, the option to purchase agreement is void. So we ask for the same result as that in Morrison for non-payment or insufficient payment according to the terms of the contract of consideration. And as I said earlier, the Lindquist case gives precedent, not binding precedent here, but persuasive precedent for the idea that ambiguous terms in a contract, or I should say consideration terms in a contract are ambiguous, where the actual amount of pecuniary interest to be paid under the contract is not determinable from reading the contract, which it is not here either. The cases, well, I see I'm down to 10 seconds, so I'll stop myself there. I'll save the rest for my 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Council Respondent, we'll turn to you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Gerald Von Korf, Rinky Noonan for the respondents. As the discussion indicated, the option granted to the Geiseys was the fulfillment of a negotiated oral agreement between Hydrocus and the Geiseys. In that agreement, Geisey agreed to provide a discount on tile installation in return for which Hadrix would pay the discounted price and provide an option. The record reflects that there was a significant amount of negotiations. Hadrix said originally that the option period should be, trigger should be 5 years, and then he asked for an indefinite period until his death. The parties, Geiseys then, to fulfill their agreement, did the installation. They invoiced the amount so that Hadrix had in front of them the amount that they were being charged. They then went to Hadrick's attorney and memorialized their agreement in the option agreement, which is Exhibit 1. 11 years later, so this, there was nothing about, I didn't get a discount for 11 years, and a complaint was served, and the complaint alleged not that there was no consideration, not that it wasn't a significant discount, but rather that the consideration which was provided in the agreement had become inadequate because Mr. Hadrick hadn't exercised the option trigger for a long time, and now the value of the property was rising too much. The complaint incorporated the agreement by reference, and the agreement itself, as the courts indicated, includes the acknowledgement of consideration. At that point, and I think it's important to understand because counsel is talking about wanting to do more discovery, but at that point, the discovery had closed on May 21, the motion was filed on July 1, 2021. Discovery had closed on May 21. There was no request for additional discovery. Motion for dispositive motions for motion to compel or a discovery dispute, that had closed. The deadline for dispositive motions was August 1, so the dispositive motion had to come in at that time.
Also, I have a question about the option to purchase background question, I guess it would be. It's a very unusual option to purchase. It froze the value of the farmland in 2011, 2012, and appears to give a life estate, more or less, to the farmer involved. And what I keep wondering when I read this is, why didn't he just sell the property then if the value of your property was that at the time and keep a life estate and have the use of the money rather than have farmland double or triple in value and be frozen at that level? In other words, it seems like a very one-sided option to purchase, and I'm not quite sure how it got there. Was there counsel on both sides fully invested in this?
There was no counsel for the Geiseys. I don't think there's anything in the record that would suggest that this was even Geisey's idea. The record reflects that originally Hadricks expected to exercise the option in a short period of time. And
the record reflects that?
I'm reasonably confident it does. Of course, there's been a bunch of depositions that were in and were out, but I know that the record reflects that originally there was going to be a much shorter period. And then Hadrick himself said, you know what? I don't want to have a rope around my neck. I'd like you to add to that. I think that the point is that Hadrick had the right at any time to trigger the option. And he has clearly made the judgment as time goes by that he would rather have another year's income or 2 years' income or 3 years' income. But that isn't, in fact, the Geiseys are upset that they would have preferred, as our motion indicates, to cut this option short. But I don't think you can hold it against Geiseys that Hadrick decided to let this go on and on. That was his decision.
Okay.
Just getting back to the posture of the summary judgment, I don't think we can say I didn't have evidence to produce because I wanted to do discovery. Rule 56.04 has a provision for doing that. There was no request for additional time. There was no affidavit. What happened is, in the response to summary judgment, this new argument was made, which is that we don't know what the total discount was. That claim is a slight red herring or a bit of evasion as to what the evidence shows. It is true that Mr. Geisey said, I didn't calculate the total of the discount. But here's what the discount was. Here's how it was calculated. The tile was done at half. I reduced the equipment rental. And I, as he put it, threw off charges, a whole bunch of charges on equipment. So to say that there's no evidence that there wasn't a significant discount is just, they've very carefully use the statement that there is nobody ever gave us the total, but in fact, they knew exactly what the discount was. And they're saying that when he was asked to calculate the total, that's hearsay because he got it from his bookkeeper.
So I just understand from your perspective, and perhaps this can be addressed in rebuttal as well, doesn't this come down to who has the burden of showing that there was or was not a substantial discount? I mean, I would normally think that, the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, appellants here, that would be their burden.
Well, I would say no because we put in evidence. So the state of the evidence in the case, even if we had the burden, all right, the evidence was the deposition of Mr. Geise. And so what the court had in front of it was a complaint that said there was consideration, an agreement that said there was consideration, Geise's testimony as to the amount of the discount applied to each element of work. And there was, if you want to compare Lindquist versus Liebling, in that case, although it's a complicated partnership agreement, the Liebling said he filed an affidavit saying, this is my partnership, no money was deposited. And then the accountant for the partnership filed an affidavit saying, I'm the accountant for the partnership. No money was placed in the partnership. So in that case, they had evidence to put that issue in issue. Here, there was absolutely no evidence to contradict. And it's really not a matter of burden of proof because Geise's met their burden, even if they had it. If you think about sitting as, which I've not had the pleasure of doing, sitting as a judge, listening to the question of a party saying, I want to put in evidence to contradict the terms of the agreement. That's what they're doing. They're undercutting the agreement they made. And so the court has really two things in mind. One, what does the agreement say? Because it might bar, as we think it does, that evidence. And second of all, counsel, tell me what the evidence is that you intend to offer. That's what happened in the Lindquist. Here, they have no evidence. So it's kind of, we said, irrelevant. We don't get to the question, as I think the cases clearly say, that this, you can't undercut the agreement in this case, not because significant is ambiguous. It's because the cases on consideration say the question, the purpose of the consideration is to show that there was arm's length bargaining, that this wasn't an accident.
Let me just ask you this. Is there a material disputed fact over whether a discount was given at all?
Absolutely not, because they put in no testimony that there wasn't, and the person who did the work testified. They put his testimony in, and transcript 11, 14, 18, 20, 31, he is saying, I discounted this, and here's how much I discounted this. And then there's a bunch of stuff that I didn't charge for at all. I don't know what the total of that is. My wife's...
We're familiar with that testimony.
Yes.
Let me ask you my second question to follow up on what I asked counsel for appellant. And that is, at the district court level, was the argument made or addressed by the district court that if there's ambiguity, we construe that ambiguity against the drafter of the option contract, which apparently, according to, as I understand the record, it was drafted by appellant's counsel.
I don't recall that we clearly said, hey, this was drafted by their own counsel, right? He made the decision to use the word significant on behalf of his client and the parties agreed to it. I think that follows, but we have never seen this agreement as ambiguous. It's not a material question as to how significant the discount was. They agreed in framing that term, significant, they agreed that it was significant. I just want to emphasize this, the argument that was made for the first time in response to our motion for summary judgment that the problem with this case is they don't have the total discount. And really, there's no rational rhyme or reason that the fact that Mr. Giese hadn't totaled the amount of his discount, he testified that both parties knew exactly the amount of discount, and here's what it was, but 11 years later, he hadn't calculated himself the total of those of that discount. It doesn't really detract from the fact that the claim that there was a discount, whether relevant or not, whether the evidence was needed or not, was unrebutted. And even if it was, there should have been summary judgment. I've got 32 seconds. If you have any questions, I'd be delighted to answer them.
Are there further questions from the panel? It does not appear that there are.
Thank you
for the argument. Counsel for appellant, we'll turn to you for the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do want to clarify in response to one of the comments that Mr. Van Korf made. It's not our contention that there's zero evidence of a discount being given. Our contention is that there's question of material fact. And there was discussion about the burden. The Morrison versus Johnson case says very clearly that the burden is on the optionee, so the Geises in this case, to show that the option was supported by a valuable consideration. That's a direct quote from Morrison. So if we assume the Geises have met that burden, then the rebuttal, the showing of a material fact question, is, as I said earlier, the inconsistent testimony of Sylvester Geise himself, where on one hand he claims to have given certain discounts, on the other hand, can't identify that he ever charged those standard rates that he claims exist to the other customers, because as he sat with the invoices for those other customers that he provided in this case, obviously they were for his company, he sat and looked at those at his deposition. There were three of them. And they were redacted, and they've always been given to us in a redacted form. So we don't know the identities of those customers either. But he looked at those slips and could not identify a single project by looking at them. So we have no idea. Like I said, there's internal inconsistencies that create a question of material fact of whether those quote-unquote standard rates had ever been charged against other customers in that same time frame. So that raises itself a question of material fact of whether a quote-unquote significant discount had been provided in this case. And the reason that that hadn't been raised for 8 years is that it really wasn't discovered until this lawsuit was commenced. And that's no different from many other lawsuits where during the discovery period, you tweak issues, you realize new issues that come about based on the evidence that comes in. And that's what we're showing here. So while the complaint, as I said earlier, significantly gave notice that the consideration under the contract was going to be at issue in this lawsuit, no, it didn't specifically say what the argument is now, and we've honed the argument down to whether a quote-unquote significant discount was actually given. And since there's a question of material fact here, this case begs to go to trial. Both the Lindquist case and the Dene case say that trial is necessary, where you have ambiguous terms, as we do here in a contract, and we need a full airing of the issues and facts in front of the trial court. It's just not an appropriate issue to be decided at this stage, especially under the insufficient facts that have been produced. And we stick by our argument that it is significant that the actual amount of this alleged discount was not able to be calculated, nor was it calculated by anybody, including the Geises, until after this lawsuit was commenced. And there is no admissible evidence of what that amount is in this record in front of a trial court. So that too creates material fact questions that require this court to send this back to trial and remand. And with that, unless there are further questions, I'll waive the rest of my time and respectfully request that this court reverse the trial court's judgment.
Are there further questions from the panel? It doesn't appear there are. The court